Hey, this is Damon, and this is the Autonicast, and joining me, as always, Alex Roy and Ed Niedermeyer. How you guys doing?
Great to see you again.
I'm doing well.
Yeah, I just saw Alex, you in person, about 4 or 5 days ago up at Thunder Hill. And it was a good weekend, actually. We had a lot of fun, but I think we'll be talking about that a little bit later. But I think we wanted to jump in first to this Navigant report that came out earlier this week, showing some really interesting people leading the research and work in autonomous vehicles. So we've got GM, Ford, kind of at the top, Nissan, Renault, Daimler's in there, BMW's in there, and in the top 10, it was pretty much just all automakers and suppliers. Is that right? Am I getting that right?
Waymo is 7.
Waymo's 7. Gotcha.
And then Tesla's 12th, which is pretty much all you need to know about the report.
Well, why do you say that, Alex?
Well, okay, so you got this report, and clearly, when the report went out, the media went crazy, and Wired runs a story, and the headline is Detroit stomping all over Silicon Valley in self-driving car race. But if you actually read the abstract of the report, the title of the report is Assessment of Strategy and Execution for 18 Companies Developing Automated Driving Systems. And so everybody skipped that, and they looked at just the raw rank, and they saw Ford in first place and GM in second, and ran these clickbait headlines. The report itself is really weird because for each manufacturer or company, they pick, Navigant picked 10 criteria, and the criteria are 9 out of 10 are weighted towards existing legacy manufacturers. So there's really no way for anyone to get up those rankings. So it makes perfect sense that...
What kind of criteria? Give me a for instance.
Okay, so number one is vision, which is totally subjective. So, Ford, having, invested in Velodyne and...
Ford Smart Mobility and pushing
Argo. So you could argue they've got a colossal vision. So there you go. A go-to-market strategy. No one knows what mobility and self-driving cars is really going to look like.
Yeah, because we're in a market of zero at the moment.
Nobody knows. Partners, everybody on this, every manufacturer that wants to stay in business has a laundry list of partners. Production strategy. If you're already making cars, you're going to win this one and Silicon Valley is going to lose. Technology, which is the only one that any startup or anybody, Tesla or Waymo have a shot at having a real ranking. The next one, number 6, sales, marketing, and distribution. FCA has a colossal arm.
Right.
So, 7, product capability. What does that mean? I mean, no one knows really. I mean, is that current products? Is that, the autonomy side? This is a fun one. Product quality and reliability. Now, how would Waymo have such a ranking? We don't know. Product portfolio. How would Silicon Valley companies rank there, except for Tesla, who manufactures cars? And then staying power. Talk about something like no one in Silicon Valley, who can say? I mean, we know that Waymo will be around because it's Google. So, out of those 10, one plays to Silicon Valley. So there's really no way they could compete in the Navigant, methodology.
So, well, then the focus really is on execution, or at least that was the impression I got from looking over this report. I'm going to give Navigant the benefit of doubt for the time being and say, so they're actually talking about companies that have a track record of producing automobiles and putting those things on the road. And we can only assume that Navigant clearly has information from inside these automakers about what their plans are and everything else that goes into that. So, to my mind, and again, trying to give Navigant the benefit of the doubt here, I understand the rationale between putting out this report saying, look, when it comes to this space, the existing players have a leg up. This is something we've talked about ad nauseum because making cars is hard. But when it comes to this kind of like future of mobility and automated driving side of things, I just don't understand how this ranking comes about when A, very little of this technology is on the road, and B, none of it's actually been proven at this point.
I think it's bigger. I think it's beyond that, because if Waymo announced a level 4 capable car tomorrow, or technology tomorrow, they make a deal with FCA, and suddenly FCA is number one. They're number one. So, you know, this whole list, you know, presupposes that self-driving technology will slot into existing everything, the existing paradigm, and there'll be no paradigm shift at all.
Here's my sort of contrarian take on this, which is that, you know, sure, this study was clearly biased towards established automakers, but, you know, the whole quote unquote autonomous, you know, race to autonomy has been dominated by Silicon Valley companies because of the fact that people don't take any of this stuff into account. People treat autonomy as a purely technical problem, and that once you solve it, you know, you've won. Well, that's not how this works. You know, you have to actually make cars. You have to have a strategy. You have to go to market. Now, I will say, frankly, I think, you know, my hat's off to Navigant for even trying to rank these companies, because I don't think we have enough information to really definitively say, you know, here's really what these companies go to strategy, you know, or go to market strategies are. Like, I maybe if they have it, that information, you know, fantastic. I should maybe, you know, buy their reports or chat with them or something, because that's cool. But I mean, I've talked with folks who know quite a bit about future plans for these companies, and, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, there's some general direction, there's some ideas, there's some, you know, broad contours, but like a developed go-to-market strategy, no one has one of those. So I question the wisdom of trying to rank these companies at all, but I do think that Navigant has made a really good point here, which is that there's a lot more to this challenge than just developing the technology. That said, I think they missed out on a really important part of that, which is government relations and regulatory engagement. I think that, you know, that's something where, for example, Waymo is just way ahead of everyone. And I think it's, you know, as we look at the evolution of autonomous driving technology, navigating the regulatory system is emerging as one of the major challenges. So I would have liked to have seen that in this report, because I think these factors that are not just pure technology problems are extremely important to this whole question.
I totally agree. And the other thing besides government relations is data, which is not the same as technology. You know, if technology is one of only 10 factors you're weighing, then, you know, it doesn't make any sense, because you could have amazing tech and not have enough data. And mapping, for example, is something where Waymo and Tesla are, you know, well, not necessarily mapping, but certainly data, miles of data gathered, you know, light years ahead of most of the manufacturers. And we don't know the exact, there's no like metric of the value of a Tesla mile versus a Waymo mile, but we know there's value. And we know even George Hotz has got 1 million miles of data. We don't know what that data is worth, but there's 1 million miles of it, and he's quite public about it. The manufacturers have been super cagey and secretive about how many miles they've driven. And I think it's probably because it's nowhere near what they want the public to know about. I mean, it's, and then of course there's the X factor, which would require like a third dimension to the board. And the X factor is that the manufacturers low on Navigant's board, who don't have a lot of tech and are very weak, instantly have it if they partner with Waymo. And so this thing could invert, like, you know, on a day's notice. I mean, so they can make an announcement tomorrow. Waymo's already got a deal with FCA. So, you know, leverage that and the hinge swings and FCA is first.
And I think one of the problem I have with the whole ranking approach, and I understand, you know, if you're marketing a research product, you know, you have to take some of these steps and you know, there's going to be some risk involved with that. But I think it sort of prompts two sort of reactions, or rather it sort of gets people sort of stuck in two of the most unhelpful sort of paradigms for thinking about this whole thing. One of which is that there's a race to autonomy.
Well, there is a race.
I disagree with that. And more importantly, even if there is a race, I think playing up the race is a really good way to create incentives for companies to cut corners, which I really don't think is what the technology needs. I think that the more these companies embrace the race aspect to it, of this, you know, like I said, the more likely they are to cut corners, which in turn could imperil the whole technology. So I think for the good of the technology, you know, recognizing that this should be pursued at a reasonably sedate pace, and I'm not talking about just slowing it down. I just people should be going as fast as they can without imperiling the future of the technology. The other thing that I think is really paradigm that I think is really unhelpful that this ranking sort of brings out is the idea that there's this, you know, competition between Detroit and Silicon Valley, or the car companies and the tech companies. And, you know, it's inevitable that people, just like the race thing, it's inevitable that people are going to think about it that way. It's just, you know, our minds work well with these sort of, you know, competitive dichotomy sort of frameworks. But like you said, Alex, you know, if Waymo develops the technology, you know, they're going to probably be able to find a partner, FCA or potentially others as well, to make cars for them. And so, you know, I don't think any one company is going to be able to do all of this stuff. I think that no matter what, you know, I think it's interesting to look at the differences between the automaker approach and the tech company approach. But I think ultimately, as you think about the end game for this, it's not going to be one winning and the other losing. It's going to be a synthesis. It has to be.
Totally agreed. Although you can't say there's not a race because, you know, Waymo's been doing this for 8 years, and Tesla's been gathering data for, you know, I don't know, say 3 or 4 years through the, you know, the user-owned cars. And Detroit and Stuttgart and Japan are spending billions to catch up. So we may not want to believe there's a race. You may say it's not productive, but there's a race because there is a psychology, and certainly it's probably part of human nature, of a fear that there is going to be a winner-take-all binary outcome here, even though logic suggests there won't be. But in the early stages, I mean, what happens if Waymo makes that announcement and partners with FCA? There's going to be heart attacks, conniptions, and pacemaker failures in Japan and Germany. No, seriously. Because what's going to happen is, everybody, Uber and everybody else, everyone's going to have to make a decision. Will they continue investing hundreds of millions in data gathering and AI development? Or will they just say, okay, we were late to this, we couldn't catch up, and license it from Waymo? And how many players will there be in the self-driving tech, you know, supplier space? And how many manufacturers will throw in the towel? And because think about it, if Waymo and FCA deploy together, and you're Daimler and your stuff doesn't work yet or meet some standard that is yet to be determined, are you willing to invest 1, 2, or 5 years more money to get your product, your self-driving product out while Waymo and FCA deploy autonomous taxi fleets in first world markets?
I think if this market is as big as people are saying it will be, and the economic opportunities are as big as people say they will be, I think clearly giving up a year or two of first mover advantage in order to have your own system that you control and that you have access to the data and that you don't, you know, that you don't have to share with a supplier or sort of, you know, like Waymo, you know, I think it's worth it, right? I mean, this is a long-term game. It's not, we all know it's not going to flip overnight.
I think you're right. I think it is worth it. But I also think that if you're, I keep using FCA as the example, but if you're at the bottom of the list, of Navigant's list, and, you know, and according to Navigant, the bottom of the list is Honda, Toyota, in terms of manufacturers, they don't even put FCA on the list at all. So you're Sergio Marchionne. You're going to cut that deal. They've already got a deal, of at least partial deal. There's no doubt in my mind. And that's going to get really scary. Let's go back to the Morgan Stanley quote. It says, you know, there'll only be 6 car makers in the future. Well, whoever doesn't have a real R&D, you know, investment or cut that deal with Waymo is off the list. They're not going to be one of those 6.
But I think that Tesla really illustrates the risk of this race situation, because I think – if you really look at what Tesla did with Autopilot, it took ADAS technology and basically presented it in a way that was riskier than any other automaker would. That Tesla's competitive advantage up until the point where they started really collecting large amounts of data, which, by the way, we still haven't quantified what that advantage is, as you as you regularly point out. But their real competitive edge was the fact that they were more risk tolerant than the established automakers who had access to a lot of the same technology. That to me, and I think, you know, we've seen with Tesla what the cost of that risk tolerance is. And I think we still haven't, that hasn't played out all the way. I think we still have more to learn about, you know, what the potential legal liability impact of being a risk tolerant player in this space is. But again, I think, you know, it's not a coincidence that Tesla is also, you know, one of the greatest risks to or generate some of the greatest risks to the long-term viability of autonomous driving because there are some risk tolerance. So it's an interesting, I mean, and to me, I think, you know, if there's one question I'd like to ask every CEO in the autonomous vehicle space, it's, you know, to what extent is risk tolerance an advantage and a disadvantage? Because obviously there are short-term advantages. Tesla has proven this. And certainly, you know, if you are a small startup that is looking for a big exit, you know, you have a lot of incentive to pump up, you know, take on a lot of short-term risk in order to get that big exit. And then, you know, you can worry about the long-term stuff when you're, you know, retired on a beach somewhere. And so I'm, you know, I'd be curious, and I think we're going to start having some guests on the show. And I think this is something I'd like to ask a lot of them, is sort of, how do you see risk tolerance? To what extent can it be a responsibly used as a competitive advantage? And to what extent, you know, if you're looking at this in the long term, is it worth leaving some short-term advantage on the table in order to manage your risk?
Well, of course, there's a philosophical dimension to the notion of risk tolerance here. Because, I mean, let's play devil's advocate and maybe throw in some philosophy and maybe some Star Trek philosophy. So if somebody dies in a vehicle which has deployed autonomous technology, and but because they've died, you know, 20 people don't, you know, it could be argued, you know, that devil's advocate, that that was, you know, worth it. I wonder what Josh Brown would say, you know, that he, so, you know, how many, 148 people died yesterday in car accidents. So Is there not a moral imperative to deploy whatever you've got as soon as you've got it?
Not if it makes people less safe.
Well, of course, less safe versus safe. If, you know, again, 20 people, lives are saved, one person died, isn't any form of autonomy? I'm not trying to trick you here, Ed, but I know exactly where you're coming from. Is there not a moral imperative to deploy this on any level?
Not, no. Well, so
if it's communicated properly, right?
Well, if it's communicated properly, but really if there's level four, or level five, then okay, I think you can make that argument. But I think at the point that anything short of that, you get into really tricky questions about, like Damon said, how do you communicate about it? How do you present the technology to people? Do you present it, you know, as we've discussed in the past, do you present it as a way to augment and improve driver capabilities? Or does it exist so that the driver can feel like they're getting a taste of the future and show off their sort of self-driving car to all their friends and feel like they're on the cutting edge of technology. I think, you know, and I made my thoughts on this pretty clear already. I think Tesla Autopilot falls into that latter category. I think it exists for its own sake, for the sake of being cool technology, rather than to solve a specific problem. And I think, there's, you know, it's, if you look at the incentives, right, that goes hand in hand with the risk tolerance, and it goes hand in hand with being a company whose most important priority is its stock price. And I just think that that's, you know, and frankly, my biggest problem with Tesla, it's, you know, that they're doing that is not the end of the world. Like, they're taking risks. Maybe they can manage it. Maybe they can't. Who knows? We'll see how that plays out. My problem with it is that Tesla is taking that strategy of being risk tolerant and sort of presenting the technology as sort of this intrinsically good thing, even though at this stage of its development it's not. And then it's attacking people who criticize it for doing it and sort of presenting itself as the leader in sort of, you know, deploying and proliferating the safety benefits of autonomous drive when their system doesn't do that. Their system doesn't exist people safer. It exists to make people feel like they're driving a self, or they're in a self-driving car.
So Ed, let me ask this question, and this might require some research. If you can't answer it, I'm knocking an opinion to the mat. Is there any math that suggests that Teslas are less safe than other cars? I mean, less safe. I don't mean equivalent, because I know Tesla's arguing that they're safer. You've argued that their claims are not valid. But is anyone arguing that they are less safe than the average, than the median for safety for comparable vehicles?
No, I mean, well, it's very hard to, right? So what I will say is that the safety statistics that Tesla has presented have been almost uniformly easily debunked, even by someone who's not a statistician like myself. And I think the key to this is that they present them, they compare Tesla's safety performance to the average, you know, the national average in the U.S., which are 11-year-old cars on average that cost on average $35,000, whereas Teslas are no more than 5 or 6 years old at the most, and you know, $70,000 to $150,000 cars. So I haven't seen a really apt comparison between sort of Tesla and really comparable vehicles. So I'm not gonna say, you know, one way or another whether they're safer or less safe. What I will say is that Tesla has consistently overstated their safety and used statistics that are just very easily debunked. And that to me raises real questions about what their priorities really are.
Well, I would argue, okay, that if we could establish, maybe Ed, you and I should chat offline about this, if we could do, you know, join heads and do some poking around and compare comparable cars to Teslas, and that if Teslas are equivalent to, or no worse than, or equivalent to, you know, in terms of safety, overall crash rates and fatalities of comparable vehicles, then Tesla, no matter what they're doing, is ahead of the curve, because while they are deploying vehicles as safe as, or safer maybe, than competitors, they are gathering data that will get them to autonomy, while competitors are running cars around that gather no data and get them no closer to a safer autonomous future.
Yeah, but we know as much about Tesla's data collection as we do about, you know, relative to competitors, as we do about its safety relative to competitors, which is to say almost nothing. And, you know, they have taken advantage of this lack of information to, you know, create a culture around themselves as a company where people just assume that they're ahead on stuff that people don't really know whether they're ahead or not, and where people assume that they're, you know, very altruistic, when I don't think that that's, you know, we don't really know what their real motivations are. Although, frankly, you know, having had some back and forth with this with Tesla, I mean, I'm pretty confident in saying that as a company, they are overwhelmingly motivated by and focused on their stock price. And that to me is, you know, that stands in contrast and kind of raises questions about, you know, the other side of their, you know, what they say their motivations are, which are very sort of altruistic and mission driven. I see a real disconnect there, and that makes me really wonder.
Sure. Just to kind of wrap this a little bit, the fundamental point that needs to be made here has less to do with the technology and more to do with how it was presented, right? So to Alex's point, yes, the Model S is safer using autopilot features, because it's an extra set of eyes beyond what the driver has, right? So if autopilot, or whatever the equivalent is, was marketed as an ADAS system that improved your abilities versus a self-driving feature, I don't think we'd be having as much of this conversation.
Probably true. I hope not, because Ed is driving me up the absolute fucking wall. look, I mean, all this, I mean, this all started because we're talking about the Navigant list, which is really the important part. We could talk about Tesla's safety to death in 18 months or 2 years. It's not going to matter, because we'll have moved past it. This Navigant list, though, I would love to see, you know, given how comprehensive and deep Navigant research is, and credit to our friend Sam Abdul Samad, whose transparency and research is unimpeachable, I'd love to see this report in a future version that defines mobility and takes a broader approach to the criteria and includes is more consistent about the players on it. Because I think including companies like Delphi on the list and ZF as separate entities, but then putting Volvo and Autoliv and Zenuity together.
Yeah, that was really strange, yeah.
Yeah, and then not including like Bosch, which just announced a partnership with, was Daimler like yesterday? I mean, and by the way, all these companies are supplying to almost every company manufacturer on the list anyway. It just doesn't lend itself to learning a lot, given how much data is behind this report.
Right. Is BMW, I mean, are they including their collaboration with Intel and well, Mobileye? Like, is that part of that? We don't know. Well, I mean, I haven't read the whole report, so I don't know.
We have to assume that it does. But again, without weighting those partnerships, you know, who was it? Was it Mark Harris or Pete Bigelow at Car and Driver? One of those guys wrote a story after CES about how Daimler had two overlapping projects internally for autonomy. And one of them was very tight with NVIDIA and one wasn't. And like, for, why isn't NVIDIA on this list? You know, they have a baseline car that they've developed with their stack that is out there. I was just at NVIDIA the other day talking about it. So it's a weird report, and I'd like to see them do a bigger, better job next time. So
Alex, you and I were up at SRC last weekend, and Autonobahn AI launched.
I wasn't going to bring it up, but we can talk about it. So every year for April Fools, I do an April Fools hoax, which is car related. In the past, I declared I'd gone cross country in 26 hours and did such a good job with fake witnesses and the cooperation of several publications that to this day, people still think I did it and that the release date of April 1st was a part of my defense from indictment. But and a couple years ago, I announced I was launching a supercar company. This year, I was so outraged by how many self-driving startups put out press releases and how incredibly just ignorant and lazy the media is in picking up. You know, every headline has, you know, self-driving car testing and blah, blah, blah city. So this year, I announced my startup from selfracingcars.com, where you and I were on Saturday. And my startup is AutonobahnAI.com. And if you and it would like to check out my website, I have a great press release. So it's Autonobahn, B-A-H-N-A-I.com. And I try to come up with a product that was suitably absurd. But incredibly, people have submitted their email addresses. I have several VCs have signed up for the mailing list. I had some press inquiries. And on Twitter, people are still retweeting it. So our announcement was that we were creating a final solution for autonomous driving safety. And I put up a picture of a $25 phono stage, you know, from Amazon, which a lot of people didn't recognize as a $25 phono stage. You can do a Google image search and find it. And the product we came up with, which apparently people want, is a device which hacks level 4 autonomy. It hacks the geofencing because, in my opinion, we can build walls around self-driving cars, but self-driving cars want to be free. But I'm telling you, Ed, that if there's a geofence level 4 car, I would like to see it drive where and just see how it works outside the geofencing. This is the device for you. It's called a GeoKnife, and it will make everyone safer because a level 4 car geofenced outside its geofencing boundaries is, I think, probably going to be safer than the average human driver. Ba-dum-bum. So
that's low bar, yes.
Yeah, a low bar, and that's that product, you know, if I keep getting VC emails, might come out. Our friend Damian Scott from Renovo, who's the head of BizDev, told me that he was at a meeting the other day, and he asked them about AutonobahnAI.com, and that I was on their radar.
That's hilarious.
It's hard to be sure if they just said that so they could sound smart or if I am, but I've got about 45 names on the mailing list, almost all VCs and a couple of friends. So anyway, let's move on.
Just real quick, your April Fool's joke was the funniest, I thought, but the close second was OS vehicle. which said that GM was acquiring them. And oh man, that was just perfect because, well, GM has a reputation for making big acquisitions that people don't seem to think make a lot of sense. And that was another one that got picked up as serious news.
Their hoax was so good, like it was indistinguishable from the real thing. Yeah. But the one I loved was Fisker announced on LinkedIn that they were offering level 6 autonomy with an aggressor mode for aggressive passing, and that it would force other vehicles out of the way. Which, if you think about it, makes sense, because if you have something like a traffic market where vehicles are fully interconnected, right, you could, in fact, have a button on the dash that charges you $10 and everyone else moves out of the way. They all get paid $1. The network gets $2. You pay. So that's
didn't Lexus do something like that with their valet mode or whatever, or the lane valet?
Yeah, I guess they did. Not as good as aggressor mode, though. I mean, come on.
No, that's yeah.
Yeah.
Alex, I was up there kind of working the entire time. You were chatting with all kinds of people up at Thunder Hill. Any major takeaways from the event? Like, this was the second year they've done it. So, you know, more people there, not as many spies as last year, but there were still plenty.
It seemed like there were fewer super early tinkering startups than last year.
Yeah, yeah.
Last year there were only like 3 or 4 journalists there. Probably this year there were 7 or 8. Tim Higgins showed up and Pete Bigelow from Car and Driver and a few other guys. You didn't have those like super tinkering guys around. Also George Hotz did not shine as brightly a character in the crowd. The spies were more diffuse. There was one spy who claimed he worked for Faraday, which maybe he was that dumb to tell me, or maybe he does work for Faraday, which would be I don't know. I can't say. There were two GPS companies, which I don't recall seeing GPS companies last year. Maybe I'm nuts. There was Sanborn Maps showed up, which was interesting. And I had a long talk with that guy, whose name escapes me, about what he described as an unserious approach to mapping by a lot of the startups.
Actually, can I pause you here really quick? So Sanborn, I wasn't that familiar with. And Ed, I'm not sure if you're familiar with them as well, but they were like one of the original map providers, like back in the 1800s, right? Like
my girlfriend's an architectural historian, and she uses old, because they used to do, they made insurance maps.
Right. Yeah. That was a major thing.
Fire insurance maps. And now for architectural historians, it's like one of the best resources because they were one of the, best earliest maps of urban centers in the US. And they did really good surveying work anyway.
I'm kind of fascinated with kind of how they're playing into this market, or how they're attempting to play into this market, because they've been around for over a century. They're obviously recognizing that mapping is incredibly important to the autonomous space and how they're shifting. So I'll be kind of keeping an eye out for them, because as many other mapping companies are in this space, Alex, you were saying that they have not been impressed with what they've seen in the startup space, or what?
Yeah, I don't think he wanted to go on the record naming names, but their argument would appear to be that they have a fleet of aircraft, and that they are doing super high resolution photography that combines aerial mapping with ground mapping, and that the startups are pretty much doing it just from cars, and even if it's LiDAR plus camera and assuming all that, it's still just from the ground, and that there's a major, major advantage to just having the high-resolution aerial mapping component. I need to have a deeper talk with them about that, because it's not a it's not a big company, certainly not like the size of here. But if autonomy is level 4 autonomy is geofenced in its initial phase, which it has to be, then having the highest quality mapping within the geofenced area is worth a lot more than having a lesser level of mapping over a wider area in which your cars are not operating. So, there's more to be heard from Sanborn, I'm quite sure.
That's a really good point, because, Mobilize, REM, and basically we're on the cusp of the next product, few product cycles, cars mass market cars that don't necessarily have autonomous drive capabilities are going to have sensors which really like are going to give the traditional automakers a huge and their partners a huge advantage in mapping, like fleet mapping, basically. And I think that that is pretty clearly going to become a commoditized thing. And so the idea of differentiating yourself with aerial mapping and things like that is very it's exciting because there's literally, I mean, there's no limit to how good these maps can be. I mean, the better they are, the better the cars will be eventually. And so I think finding that unique niche, it sounds promising.
And by the way, when I was the day after the Celebration Cars event ended, I went down to LA and I went down to and I got in my Turo and it didn't have GPS in it because this particular fleet of Albanians had the stripper model Infinities in the fleet. Anyway, no, I'm not making a joke. There's like an Albanian group that only has stripper Infinities and Fiats near LAX. Anyway, all strippers, no GPS. So I used Google Maps and Waze, and neither of them could find, I think the address was 215 South La Cienega. Neither of them could find it, and on foot or by driving.
Oh, strange.
And yeah, and this is one of the most, you know, most important markets in the world for self-driving cars. And there is still a long way to go in terms of mapping and addresses, a lot. So anyway.
Either way, I want to reach out to Butler. Do you guys know Butler Maps? So they basically do, they're kind of specifically to motorcycle maps. So it is the best secret because it's all back roads. It's all twisties. I used to use those maps when I was planning like review drives and that kind of thing.
I mean, I'm curious, how does a company like Butler Maps stay in business? I mean, they literally haven't.
Just enthusiasts. Although I think they partnered with a motorcycle app. I think it's Rever or something like that, where they actually, you pay a subscription fee essentially through Rever. And or whatever the app is, and you've got the Butler Maps experience on your phone.
Well, that's, I mean, and is it crowdsourced plus baseline maps they get from someone else?
You know, honestly, I don't know. I mean, they've had great mapping data for years, so I would assume a lot of it's just carryover because a lot of these roads obviously don't change too much. But but yeah, no, they're an interesting company and just a great resource across the board. So anyway, so getting back to SRC really quick. One of the, you know, you were mentioning earlier kind of the lack of hobbyists. And I think we saw a bit of a break this year because so there are two kind of self or like racing autonomous car programs out here now. So there's like self-racing cars, which is the big thing. And then the crew from 3D Robotics, so Chris Anderson, former mm-hmm. editor-in-chief of Wired, they've been doing monthly meetups at, I think, like a karting track in Oakland, and that's where they're running like 8th and 16th scale autonomous, like autonomous carts and RC cars, that kind of thing. And so we saw a bit of a split this year, mainly because it looks like the people that are kind of working on these smaller projects, the hobbyists, as we said earlier, just didn't really see the need to come all the way up to Thunder Hill when they can do their test and tunes in Oakland and all that. But we did see a kind of a small track that was set up for these essentially RC cars outfitted with sensors and mapping data and all that, which are freaking fascinating. Like I you know, if I could code to save my life, I would probably be working on one right now because just to learn the technology, be it just the vision technology, how it's interpreted, how all this information sent over, just like I said, if I needed a hobby, I would be on this.
So Alex, you've been to both of them, right? Damon, did you go last year as well?
Yeah, I was there last year. Yeah.
All right. So my question for you guys is, how long will it be before one of these autonomous cars can lap Thunder Hill faster than a human in the exact same car? How close are we to that?
With this current group? Negative.
Not, I mean, just project the growth you've seen in the last year forward.
Yeah, I just don't think to be honest, I don't think the self-racing cars event really has shown that much of progress. You know, we're seeing the technology getting better, obviously, but you know, this is still to a certain extent just a hobbyist event with players that are there trying to get data. I mean, anybody that's serious in this space is renting out tracks and renting out testing locations on a regular basis and not telling us about it, right? So, you know, I don't think we're, you know, we're certainly not seeing the best and brightest at the SRC event when it comes to actually what they're showing, right? A lot of the engineers that are working on that stuff are there, but the in that environment, we're not seeing it. And I mean, if we're honest, like, we've already seen modified vehicles going around the track, you know, on pace with human drivers, but that was also using like GPS coursing and that kind of thing. So I remember I was at like Laguna Seca, God, it must have been 5 or 6 years ago, where BMW set up a bunch of GPS and data beacons, had somebody that was a hot shoe go around, record a bunch of laps, and then the car basically just parroted exactly what they did. And we've seen these systems getting better over time. So you can think about some of the systems now that are like able to sense traction, particularly with electric vehicles, and then make minute tweaks to motor output to make sure you've got maximum traction and everything else. But for an event like this, we're still a far way off. I'd be way more interested to hear that hear somebody from like RoboRace that's been, you know, working on this stuff for the last 2 years and kind of seeing their trajectory.
I mean, you're completely right there. I mean, it's too bad that, well, maybe it's too soon for self-racing cars, the event, to actually have an official competition. You know, I was amused, you know, when George Hotz was running around saying, what's my lap time? What's everyone else's lap time? He was really, really feeling competitive about it. But there's no, you know, there's no classes or tiers. There's no structure to the event. You rung what you brung, and there's no official competitive component. And yet, there were people there, Hotz being one of them, you know, really, really excited about his time. You know, it's going to be years before we see anything come out of that event or any other event, because as you said, the main players don't want to show their hand. I'll be honest with you, the mystery to me about autonomous racing is that, you know, RoboRace has these spec cars, which are beautiful and designed by the Tron guy. I fail to understand, and I would love to be educated, and I've asked a lot of people, how autonomous race cars, how they will learn racecraft, you know, I mean, actual racecraft, because you can get a car to follow a line around a track, a GPS line, perfectly. But the decision-making on a racetrack among multiple cars running different AIs is another level of complexity beyond navigating roads. The speeds, I fail to understand how it's going to work unless the companies that are going to, the teams entering RoboRace would partner with, say, Turn 10. You know, if you look at the game companies, you know, there are elements, there is AI built into Forza Motorsport for the computer-controlled cars. And the computer-controlled cars don't all drive identically. They have their own characters. Last year, I asked Dan Greenewalt, who's, the head of Turn 10 Studios, whether he'd been contacted by anyone from the self-driving sector. So, and he said no. So he's either lying, which I don't think so, or the self-driving company, especially anyone in autonomous racing, have not really thought far enough about how to solve that. I just don't get it. Video game.
To my mind, I don't think it's an issue, because it's the same thing of like programming in situational awareness with autonomous vehicles. Like, it's just taking that to its logical extreme, right?
Yeah, well, this is the challenge, right? Is the social aspects of driving, you know, which I disagree, by the way, Alex, that it's really harder on a racetrack. I think there are different challenges, but in both cases, whether you're on a racetrack or driving in traffic,
still going the same, you know, direction. There's no intersecting streets. There's no intersecting cars. Like,
right. There's navigating the maze, which is part of the problem, and we're still kind of working on that one. But I think the real challenge for AVs is because, you know, human beings are such we're social creatures, and a lot of our social interactions we're able to navigate with subconsciously, and I think that's something that computers are going to really, really struggle with, and I think it's just as big of an issue on the road, if not more, than on the racetrack, because we are able to intuit, you know, fairly accurately what other drivers are going to be doing when you're racing against them. There's that psychological battle, but also on the road, you know, there's a lot of, you know, well, this person's driving this car and they've, you know, done these. And again, we do this subconsciously. There's these subtle cues that tell us, you know, what to expect from someone. And I think that is the challenge for self-driving cars. It's more than just navigating a maze.
Well, I know we're going to have to, I'm going to reach out to Dan Greenewalt and ask if he will be a guest on the show. And then we need to get someone from RoboRace on, because I think, I don't think I agree with you, because at the end of the day, a self-driving car on city streets has one goal. The first goal, like the Asimov's law of robotics, is to get the occupant from A to B in one piece. And in racing, so you have a risk cap that has to be built into the AI of any self-driving car on public roads. There's a cap to behavior. There are things it cannot even consider doing. Whereas in a race car, you have a variable cap. Every human driver in a race car is constantly saying, will I take this risk or not? Risks well beyond the threshold of what a self-driving car in the streets will take, because they can slow down and stop.
Look at the Uber crash. You know, they were racing to hit the light. They were trying to get through a yellow, and that was a contributing factor in that crash. And I think that, you know, it's nice to think that, you know, everyone's going to program their self-driving car to be as safe as possible. But the reality is, and I would really recommend, there's a great piece on Medium by Autonomous Law, who's also on Twitter. I highly recommend following him. It's actually at Safe Self-Drive. He has a fantastic piece about a minor incident in Tempe is Uber's biggest missed opportunity to date. And I think he really makes this point incredibly well, that there needs to be more of an emphasis on safety. But in reality, right, it's not there. These companies are taking risk, and probably for Uber's sake, you know, there's a premium to knowing that your cars will be able to get point A to point B as fast as possible, so you can really jam in as many rides, whereas other people, maybe that will be less of a priority. So I don't think it's a settled thing that, you know, that autonomous cars on the road are, you know, always erring on the side of safety. I wish that were the case, but
I can't wait to see the control, I guess the team control, you know, booth for RoboRace, where the only control is a button to pit and the other control is a knob with aggression level. You know, and I guess the corollary for self-driving cars, I guess, you know, as per Riley Brennan's wonderful article about what are the metrics for the management of a self-driving fleet, is going to be, you know, uptime, you know, what is uptime, profitability, and whatnot. And I guess, you know, Uber's knob will be, you know, rides per hour, and they'll be dialing it past maybe the threshold of safety. I hope not.
So last thing I just wanted to throw out there is the latest with the Uber and Waymo lawsuit. So props to Ryan Felton over at Jalopnik for kind of compiling the latest. I don't even want to quite call it a scandal.
Ubergate.
Yeah, it's so weird. Like, so, you know, it was a combination of like Lewandowski has a property in Berkeley that a company that he may or may not have had an investment in was renting from, and they later like merged, and that was part of one of the programs he was working on while he was allegedly double dipping at Google. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on.
And I think this is where, you know, once again, you have this disconnect between sort of the rhetoric, which is all, you know, we want to make the world a better place and eliminate all accidents, and we're just here to help and make things better. And then on the other hand, you know, you see, guys making $120 million and that's not enough. And they allegedly go and you know, rip off their employer that is, again, allegedly, that has paid them $120 million for their services. There's a disconnect there. And I think that, you know, maybe part of the answer, right? You're not going to make people less greedy. It's going to be the gold rush is there. It's going to be a thing, but, maybe actually dialing back the safety rhetoric might actually just kind of be more realistic about the PR that you're putting out there. Because people can tell when there's that disconnect.
Well, I can't add anything to the Schadenfreude and the humor of all this, except that yesterday Oliver Cameron, who was at Udacity, announced that he's launching Voyage, which is a company that's going to compete with Uber. And the timing of the announcement is really really something, because Udacity just launched not that long ago, and the timing would seem perfect to try to basically cull staff from Uber's autonomous driving unit. I can't imagine who over there wants to stay at this point. And, you know, kudos to Cameron for announcing when he did, because you got to believe he got a lot of phone calls today.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've also heard a little bit more about
Aurora.
Aurora, yeah.
Yeah, Chris Urmson and Sony Anderson, who raised $3.5 million. Which goes back, by the way, which ties back to the Navigant report. If manufacturing is everything and the tech can just slot right in and is as significant, then why are all the best people in autonomous research launching fresh companies to build a full stack? Which Aurora, apparently, they're going to offer a solution like Waymo's, the full stack that will slot into manufacturer's car. So.
Yeah, and we saw more coming out about Zoox this week as well, which has always been very much under the radar.
Oh, actually, I'm surprised that no one brought up Rosekind, former NHTSA administrator Rosekind, going to Zoox, which is, I mean, he deserves its own episode.
Yeah, Ed, I suspect you might have something to say on former legislators joining startups.
Former regulators, yeah. I'm not a huge fan, frankly. I think. And NHTSA's report on Tesla Autopilot was not great. And, and I know that even other autonomous drive companies had complained to NHTSA about the way Tesla was deploying Autopilot, sort of sharing my concerns that I voiced earlier about the risk that Tesla's choice of deployment strategy presented to the technology as a whole. And the response that came out of Rosekind's NHTSA was, you know, we don't want to be the bureaucrat who stands in the way of innovation. That sounds good, but the reality is, you know, when you go and get a job at a tech startup, people know what that really means, which is, I won't get a job making a lot of money at a tech startup if I'm the bureaucrat who says, hold up a second, maybe we need to, prioritize safety here rather than,
So you think there should be a 7-year rule for people leaving NHTSA before they go to a company that they regulated?
I mean, I wouldn't mind it if I felt like the regulators, you know, took their job seriously when they're in office. I don't know. I mean, it's a very complicated question, the whole revolving door thing. It's a much broader problem in DC, and there have been attempts to solve it in all kinds of areas, and none of them, frankly, have really worked. So I'm sort of not wildly optimistic that anything is going to change this, but I definitely think that there's more reason why, you know, safety advocates need to really step up and make their voices heard, because the reality is you can't just trust the regulators, because they're thinking about, you know, their own future career prospects down the line. And a lot of times, cutting companies slack. Obviously sometimes there's political incentives to do that, but also, as we see, there's personal incentives to do that. So I think folks who are really serious about advocating for automotive safety in this country, which we need more of, those folks really need to not assume that NHTSA just is going to do a good job, and really be the one that stands up for safety, because excuse me, they have other incentives.
Well, with that, should we wrap up our podcast?
Yeah, I just want to shout out a Portland company who's getting into the self-driving car area, Mentor Graphics. They've got a really interesting concept. They've been testing it with sensor data. Frankly, basically the idea is just that they're taking, instead of having a microcontroller with every sensor, they're sort of taking that away and creating a central processing sensor fusion system that allows you to use sort of raw sensor data And they say there's a lot of opportunities. They think they can get level 5 with under 100 watts of power, of compute power. You know, theoretically can use x86 or ARM processors. So it certainly looks like the kind of thing that reflects sort of what I think a lot of people in the OEM world have been thinking about, which is the need for sort of a reboot instead of just this steady evolution of sort of agglomerating systems onto each other and sort of building up over time, which gives you a very disjointed and inefficient system. I think there's been a lot of talk in the industry about this kind of clean sheet. I don't know that Mentor has, this is the one, and they're going to start testing later this year. I hope to get a ride with it and keep an eye on it. But, don't have a lot of Portland companies in the space to shout out, so thought I'd do that.
So are they paying you?
No, they're not paying me. No.
Right, just so we're clear, I've been helping out. I've been helping out Turo a bit, and I liked them so much when I was covering them that I decided to do some consulting work for them, just so no one thinks that I have any conflicts I'm not exposing. People always think that I'm working for Tesla. I am not. I don't even own Tesla stock.
We have one more thing. If you like the show but are kind of sick of the three of us, we have some good news, which is that we're going to start having some guests on the show. We have not finalized sort of the format of how we're going to do that. But I think either way, there's a lot of really smart people, obviously, in this space who are also really fun to talk to about these issues. So we have a couple lined up for the next couple weeks. Our first one will probably be Riley Brennan of Stanford University's REVS program, who was actually the guy who suggested that we do this podcast. So he's got to be our first guest.
Absolutely.
And then hopefully Josh Harden of PolySync, another Portland company, will hopefully be joining us after Riley. And so my request here is if you enjoy the show and you're looking forward to us having guests, let us know who you want to see. Come on. And you can just tweet any one of us or all three of us. It would probably be the best way to get it to us. So just send us your suggestions, and we would love, to hear your ideas about who to have on as guests.
And let's also not forget that we're also trying to get on Dr. Maya Rockymore from a think tank out of Washington, who's going to talk about the consequences of automation on social policy, which should be very, very, very fascinating.
So. Yeah, I'm really excited about that.
Excellent. Well, gentlemen, enjoy the week. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
See ya.